Attention, please. Eastern Airlines Flight 19, your holiday cruise to the emerald beauty of a Puerto Rican rainforest, now ready for departure.
Oh, hello there. So glad you could come along.
Wait a minute. I love that idea. How about some backstage passes?
Oh.
How did you get here?
We entered a contest.
Yeah, we lost.
We're now leaving the land of fantasy and entering the world of the future.
WDW Radio, your information station.
Do you ever walk through the Disney parks and say, how did they do that? Or better yet, who helped bring these incredible places and spaces to life? Well, I was recently invited behind the scenes at Walt Disney Imagineering in Glendale, California, and sat down with Zolt Hormé, the creative force behind some of Disney's most iconic environments, from the Tree of Life to Cars Land to the floating mountains of Pandora and Galaxy's Edge. And in our exclusive one-on-one conversation, Zolt reveals how stone becomes story, how culture and emotion are carved into every detail, and how his team's work quite literally shapes the magic we feel in the parks, including the breathtaking new Fantasy Springs in Tokyo DisneySea. You'll also get more insight and personal stories about Imagineering as a whole. I also posted the entire video version on my WDW Radio YouTube channel, and I'm going to share more about what I saw, experienced, and learned during my unforgettable visit to Imagineering on an upcoming podcast episode, so stay tuned. And hello, my friend, and welcome to WDW Radio, your guide to the Disney parks, movies, and experiences from around the world. I am Lou Mangiello, and this is show number 836, and this one is a little bit different. If it sounds different in the background, it is because I am recording from a wonderfully beautiful and shady spot here at the Jolly Holiday at the end of Main Street, USA in Disneyland. I was just on our WDW Radio Adventures by Disney. I stayed to visit Imagineering to have this tour and interview with Zolt. Remained to see the Walt Disney Audio Animatronic and the new show, Walt Disney A Magical Life, and I'll be here for a few more days to cover Disneyland's 70th anniversary. So whether this is your first time listening or you've been with me since the beginning, welcome home, and more importantly, thank you. I would literally not be here and be able to share this interview with you if it wasn't for you, because for more than 20 years, I've been able to share my love of Disney through the podcast and live shows and events and cruises and our incredible community, which you are a part of. And for that, I am so grateful that if you are here, remember, you're not a listener. You are a part of the WRO family. A quick few things before we dive in. Don't forget to join the community and conversation over at wwradio.com/clubhouse. There's a lot of very interesting conversations going on right now, and feel free to come over, start your own. Be sure to join me this and every Wednesday at 7:30 p.m. Eastern on Facebook and YouTube for WDW Radio Live, and get a little bit of Disney every week in your inbox, plus a free gift by subscribing to my free email newsletter at wwradio.com/newsletter. Again, this week's podcast, a little bit different. I'm going to skip the trivia this week because I am out and about and really want the focus to be on Zolt and my conversation with him. And again, I'm going to have much more to share from the Walt Disney Autotronic to my visit to Imagineering to Disneyland 70th. I've been sharing a lot on my Instagram and on my stories and reels. Certainly going to share more on the podcast as well. And if you, and you should, want to come to Disneyland, don't forget to visit mousefantravel.com for free expert planning, just like I have trusted for more than 18 years. And if you like this episode and the show as a whole, please rate, review, and more importantly, share it with a friend. It really helps and means more than you know. But for now, sit back, relax, and enjoy this week's very special episode of WDW Radio. If you've ever stood beneath the floating mountains of Pandora, if you've ever gone past the immersive cliffs of Cars Land, if you've ever stood in awe at the carvings of the Tree of Life, if you've seen the artistry of Zolt Hormé as the chief executive at Walt Disney Imagineering, he doesn't just build rockwork, he sculpts emotion, shapes stories, and transforms blank canvases into living, breathing lands that truly move us. And his journey, from his roots in Hungary
to the highest peaks of Imagineering is fascinating and as layered as the landscapes that he creates. And it's an absolute honor and a privilege to be invited to these hallowed halls of Walt Disney Imagineering in Glendale, California, to explore the stories behind the stone, the secrets behind the sculpting, and the philosophies that guide his work. I am excited to step behind the scenes into the world of Zsolt Hormé. Zsolt, it is a pleasure meeting you. Thank you so very much.
A very, very kind introduction. Thank you. I'm honored and humbled.
No,
very nice to meet you as well, Lou. Thank you for having me.
I will explain why this is a full circle moment for me, but I'm also, you know, I'm a sucker for the origin story. So your journey, I think, to Imagineering is as extraordinary as some of the world that you help create. Take us back to the beginning, from growing up in Hungary to being a creative executive at WDI, and maybe how some of those early influences shaped you as both an artist and a storyteller.
Ooh, that's way back. So yes, I grew up in Hungary. You know, I was born and educated in Hungary, and you know, at the time it was a communist country, and I just didn't feel like I fit too well. So I decided, you know, why don't I go and try, you know, my luck and talent and the eagerness to create, you know, in America. So, you know, one day, you know, I just decided that this would be the time to go. And my wife at the time and I basically left Hungary, you know, and left the communism and came to America to look for freedom and being able to do what I actually ended up doing, you know. So that's why we're here today. So it was a lot of risk taking, a lot of unknown, a lot of enthusiasm and frankly bravery. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're 22 years old, you know, and didn't speak the language at all, you know. So actually we went to France first because I spoke French, so I studied French in school, so that was kind of like an intermediate safety zone, you know, in a way. And then went through the whole process of, you know, being accepted and ended up in Lansing, Michigan, you know, as our new home in America. And, you know, thinking back, it was a wonderful experience because it's a small town. It was easy to kind of, you know, integrate, find friends, family, and we're taken in by a Hungarian lady who had 6 children that she was bringing up alone. They were grown by that time, but so since she had a kind of like an empty nest, you know, she heard that we would be, you know, coming, and she offered to take us in, which was a wonderful, wonderful, really, gesture on her part. But that gave us a home, gave us a base where we can actually learn the language, learn about America, which we really didn't know much about at all, you know, except the movies. But, you know, I didn't realize that just because it's a shoe store, they're going to have your size always. So I had to learn. Yeah, you know, maybe you have to go to 2 or 3 before you find something that fits you. But other than that, you know, it was a great experience because really it gave us a chance to learn a little bit about what America's all about and how the people are here and how the work is here and so on and so forth. So I'm still, even today, living in the States for such a long time, wonder how newcomers come here and end up in New York or Los Angeles with the traffic, learning how to drive. It's like, whoa, man, it's pretty daunting even today. So I feel we're pretty fortunate, you know, starting our life in America in a smaller town and you know, get integrated. So then when we came, then you have to find a job right away. So that was called the refugee services that helps, you know, refugees to kind of get established. So being an artist and being educated as an artist, you know, I was looking for something on the creative end.
So as a kid, were you always sort of, you know, a little bit more on the creative side?
Always,
were you building
yeah.
things? And
I always, in my whole family, we had musicians. My father was a painter, a graphic artist. We had sculptors. The whole family was very, you know, artistically inclined and oriented. So that gave me the jumping board, if you will, to kind of continue that thread. And since I was young, I used to sing, you know, in the choirs and did theater and performance art and all that stuff. So yes, basically all my life was kind of surrounded mm-hmm. with art and artists. And that kind of helped me to kind of adapt, you know, what is art in America, you know? So the only job that was available within the realm of art, you know, was a putt-putt golf course in East Lansing, right? And it was all covered with snow. And this gentleman was helping out. So we pulled up with a car and I'm thinking, what is that? And he said, I don't know what this is, but they told me it was a creative thing, you know. So we met the contractor who was working on it, and then I basically had a short interview. I got, you know, hired for that, you know, golf course design job. It was really, really cold, snowing all the time. It was absolutely miserable, actually, working in a little garage, you know. Somebody was welding in a corner. Somebody was mixing cement in the other corner. It was a little makeshift shop for sure. But they basically that kind of opened up, you know, learning about construction and because it was such a small scale, I ended up learning how to weld, how to build, how to sculpt, how to spray cement, all the little steps mm-hmm. in the process that I'm relying on today, even still. So that was once again a very fortunate, you know, kind of opportunity for me to be able to spread my wings, right. You know, working on that small project. And basically the story continues after that the gentleman I was working with, he really wanted to do something with Disney. So we actually drove all the way down from Michigan to Florida and basically had a demonstration. It was right during the first half of the construction of Typhoon Lagoon. And we did that demonstration. I did a little sculpting exercise.
Have you been doing a lot of like exterior landscape sculpting and rock work?
Zero. All new. I mean, in Europe, this wasn't a business. Yeah. Now it's a little bit more with zoos and all that, but really, especially in Hungary, I mean, nobody did that kind of stuff. So everything was a learning process, if you will, you know, going through the years and still is, by the way, but it's a little different.
Say yes and then figure out how to do it along the way.
Exactly. Yeah. That's it. Yes, exactly. So then basically one way or the other, I ended up getting a job with Disney as a sculptor, not as a WDI art director, because you had to make a choice. So in Florida, if you wanted to touch the material and actually do the work, you had to become part of the union. So art directors could not perform the work, you know. So then I ended up going through the union, which was great because you learn about the material applications, the trade, all that. So that helped me to really, really learn a lot about not just what we're trying to do, but how to achieve it. So that helped me in the future a lot, because instead of just saying to somebody, well, can you just kind of make it, you know, a little smoother, whatever, you can tell them, take that trial or do this, and then you'll achieve that, you know. So that was a really, you know, helpful thing to have. And then after that, after Typhoon Lagoon, I worked on Catastrophe Canyon. And then finally I got hired, you know, for, it was a little interim, because the work kind of ran dry. So I ended up, you know, continuing trying to make a living somewhere else, but then got called back. And I became actually a field art director and production designer on Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, mm-hmm. which was based on a movie, you know, that I learned much, much later that John Landau actually produced, mm-hmm. who I ended up working with and, you know, during the construction of Pandora. So funny, like talking about a circle of, you know, of life sometimes. And that was a very challenging, beautiful project, because imagine trying to design and deliver a playground, you know, with all the safety requirements and the creative requirements and just a tight logistical situation that we ended up having to work within. So it was a great experience. And then right after that, I ended up going to Paris and became actually the overall Rockwork art director, believe it or not, at 24, for the park at Disneyland Paris. So you know, us who worked on it, we always say Euro Disney, but then they changed the name in midstream, and it's still, you have to think twice, okay, is it Euro Disney or is it Disneyland Paris? And so it's Disneyland Paris now. But so that was a wonderful experience because, you know, you really met a lot of very talented people. And not just that, but most people probably don't know, but even today we're working together. Who, you know, young people we met, you know, Rui, for instance, Rui D'Amatos and Fabrice Canal. Rui became one of the leading expert in the world, actually, creating character facades and architecture and basically the theme buildings that you see in the parks. And then Fabrice and I, you know, continued the rock work field. And we're still working together, you know, within the studio that we have right now, which is called Team Finishes Art Studio, which I'm the head of.
Yeah, it's interesting. First of all, I love your story because I think so many of the greatest origin stories involve taking those big leaps of faith, just picking up and going to a new country and then figuring out how you're going to sort of build your wings on the way down. And I think so many artists, you know, they work in mediums of paint or clay or marble, and you sort of found your way into working with rock. And I said that this is a sort of a full circle moment because I first remember reading your name in Melody Malmberg's book about the making of Disney's Animal Kingdom.
Yeah.
And I was fascinated because I love the minutiae and the details and the layers of storytelling that are not necessarily the things that you're seeing in attraction, but that are the world building. And you were featured in the book about, you know, being the lead sculptor on the Tree of Life. And I began to just start to understand how much artistry went into the creation of the parks. And I was sort of fascinated about how you turned that structure, which we know is sort of based on an oil rig, into something else with story and emotion. And I think the way you use concrete as your medium really stuck with me. So working on that project and a project at that scale, what did that teach you technically or artistically that maybe still influences you in the work that you do today?
Well, the Tree of Life was really a very unique challenge and a beautiful moment in our career who were involved with it. And that was really the first project. Being in Florida, you know, I mentioned the union, you know, everything was done, you know, within the union, within the trade. But, you know, Tree of Life was really such a special, you know, project that we decided and we realized that we really need to hire well-rounded, experienced sculptors. You know, this is not something that you can teach somebody who is very familiar with the tools and the materials and plastering and so on and so forth, but how you sculpt 325, you know, animal figures onto a, you know, onto a 75.
Yeah, right. Scale. Yeah.
On that scale, it was a huge challenge, and we realized that. And so the company decided, okay, we're going to go ahead and create something new in terms of how we're going to approach the construction and the building of it. So I had the opportunity to actually put a team together. And I figured, man, Tree of Life, that's the centerpiece of Animal Kingdom. We have got to have some Native American presence within the team. So I actually did a lot of research and ended up hiring three very well-known Native American artists and basically people from Disneyland Paris I brought in. So we had people from Ireland, from France, Native Americans. We had the local, you know, colleagues that were part of the team. So me being Hungarian, it was a pretty eclectic international team on a much, much smaller scale than what we ended up doing here in Fantasy Springs just not long ago, but we'll get to that. But basically, you know, to realize that, you know, and of course, working with Joe Rohde, and Joe really wanted to make sure that he wasn't micromanaging at all, which was great. He just said, look, I just want to make sure that the animals are clearly, you know, understood which species, which type of animal, you know, anatomically they have to be correct. So we can't just fudge things. You know, they had to look like a grizzly bear. You know what I mean? And that was a challenge because just you learn how creating an armature, you know, cannot look like the finished product. And I told the craftsman. If it looks good, then you're doing something wrong, because we still have to put cement on top of all that, and that allows, or it won't allow, you know, for certain parts of the body to be, you know, pronounced properly and so on and so forth. So we really had to study how to change the armature into a base where we can add another 2 or 3 inches of cement on top and still maintain the proportions and the anatomical correctness of the animal figures. So that was a discovery, if you will, because I never done that before.
So say how much changes from going from a concept design and model, scale model, to being out in the field and putting the cement down and seeing something doesn't work, or maybe you have a creative input. Is there any change that happens at that stage, or is it basically execution of the design as it's laid out?
Yes, that's a great question, because we have such a small portion of the design left to manipulate. If you think about just the scale of everything, we usually start with a very small scale model. You know, 100. You know, or here in the States, we say, you know, a 16th of an inch, quarter of an inch, so on and so forth, half inch to a foot. So basically, if the model has something that's a half inch, that's usually a foot in reality. So, but we start with a small model, we create the lay of the land, kind of like almost sketching at first. And then we step up to a larger scale where we start defining, you know, the locations of certain things, where the paths are, where the restaurants are, so on and so forth. And then the normal scale that we actually reference the design from to the full scale, it's the half inch to a foot. And but you have to have everything in place, but it cannot possibly be, you know, the same thing that the finished product. So there is quite a bit of latitude that we have to deal with, whether it might be a correction, whether it might be an addition, or just an evolution of the design. But yeah, it does change quite a bit, because, you know, it's in full scale, and your eye and your approximate, you know, position, how you look, where you're looking at from, you know, the where the public can see it from. You have to calculate all that into the work and make sure that whatever you do and spend time and energy on, first of all, it's visible, and it's clearly, you know, perceived by the guest. And where it's not the case, then obviously you don't put that much effort or energy in there, you know?
Yeah, because I was thinking, you know, even getting out there and seeing, well, this doesn't feel right, right? This doesn't feel right as I lay it, or what's it going to look like, how, depending on how the sun hits. And you have, like, I read a quote that you said, you sculpt stories, which I love. And how do you sort of ensure that the rock work and the themed finishes sort of acts more like a character in the narrative rather than something that just acts more as a background?
That's a great, great question, because it is really what we do in themed finishes. We're supporting the narrative. So our job is to tell the story through color, texture, buildings, you know, landscape, hardscape, artificial foliage. So there are a lot of disciplines that have to work together, besides the fact that we have to interact with 140 plus different disciplines throughout the process: landscape designers, engineers, ride engineers, architects, you name it. So it's a really intertwined, complex, but a really fun process, really. So you always start with basically a great team. You have to have a good team. And that's what I really pride myself about a little bit to over the years, to really maintain and develop a great team, a cohesive team. We work together as a family, not just colleagues, you know. We spend a lot of time after work. We support each other, you know, not just you know, at work, but on a personal basis. So it's really a little community that's very unique in its own way, you know. But basically, working together over the years, we get to know each other. We help each other to develop, you know, further. So it's a great culture that's been created over the decades, pretty much.
You also
did I answer your question?
Yes. You said that you think in three dimensions, which, as I was thinking about sort of your process and how you do that, how you go from ideation to full-blown execution to getting it in front of guests. What does that sort of creative brainstorming look and feel like for you, whether it's, you know, a project like The Tree of Life on such a huge scale, or even some of the smaller, visually sort of small elements that we'll see in the parks?
I'll give you an example. For instance, when we were working on Pandora, you know, we were kind of entertaining different ideas. And at one point, Joe Brody called me and said, look, we're going to kind of move into another approach. And I said, okay, what would that be? And he said, well, I don't know, man. I mean, floating mountains. I don't know. Maybe floating mountains. I'm thinking, wow, that is probably the most difficult subject matter you could pick out of the whole movie, right? But I took it as a great challenge. So basically, got together and started crumpling paper, wires, you know, sticks, you name it. And then we just start playing with it. And okay, what about this? What about that? Is this really floating? Not yet. How about adding this? Maybe we need another smaller island just to support the bigger one, so on and so forth. So it's really a lot of brainstorming, challenging the impossible. Mm-hmm. And all that talent, you know, kind of put together and working together, it's almost like energizing mm-hmm. each other, you know, so you can actually achieve and create things much, you know, on a level of impossible almost, because of the team and how we work together and how we encourage each other or challenge each other for that matter.
Right.
But it's always that, you know, you have to make mistakes at the beginning. Otherwise, you're not trying hard enough. You know, so you have to be ready. Okay, let me try that and be ready that it might not work the way you thought it would work. But then, okay, fine, put it aside and we do something else until you feel like, okay, we're onto something, and then you just keep pursuing that.
So Pandora, I think, is a great example, because I was thinking, I'm sure that process has to be different for you creatively than creating something that's grounded in reality, right? Creating something that exists in Africa, that exists mm-hmm. in New Orleans, wherever it might be. How do you sort of strike that right balance between realism and, you know, quote unquote magic, without sort of tipping too far one way or the other?
When we finished Disneyland Paris, you know, that park was really mostly based on realism, you know, Big Thunder and Adventure Island, so on and so forth. So you kind of got your brain almost ingrained and wired to make sure that whatever you do, it's as believable and as authentic and geologically faithful as you can possibly make it. So we completed that park, and then I moved back to the States, and my next project was Toontown, which could not be any further from Disneyland Paris, right? So we were working on a sample program, and I was sculpting these pilings, and the creative director came by and says, yeah, those looks good, Joe. It's way too busy. Okay, all right, let me simplify it. Then he comes back and says, okay, it's better, but it's really way too busy. And I'm thinking, oh, my Lord, I mean, do you want me to do nothing? You know, being a little bit frustrated. And then I realized, okay, well, you know, you're basically sculpting like a gigantic paintbrush, you know, so everything you do, it has to feel like it was just, you know, the brush just stroke a piece of paper, you know, and that really helped to turn my mind and basically create and come up with a completely different vocabulary than I was used to. And that actually happened over the years, really almost from project to project, because either you have to be faithful to the animated feature, or you have to be faithful to the geology. An example, for instance, when we were working in Tokyo and in Japan from 98 to 2000, that was right after the Tree of Life. So we completed the Tree of Life, and then an Animal Kingdom opened, and then we moved to Tokyo right away. And I was in charge of Mount Prometheus and the rest of the rock work, but I was focusing really on Mount Prometheus because it's the largest man-made sculpture in the world even today. Mm. And And we really wanted to do something special and very realistic and really tell a story that's that doesn't remind the Japanese people of their Mount Fuji. So we intentionally used geological references from Hawaii and Hawaiian volcanoes. We actually did go to Hawaii, Fabrice and I, and studied, took thousands of photographs, you know, to be able to use as a reference. And so we built a park. You know, went on with our careers. And years later, I heard that there was this scientist, a very well-known scientist, geologist in Japan, and he went to the park and he looked at Mount Prometheus and started walking around. And he actually just was taken back by really the fidelity of what we have created. And apparently there's a YouTube series by him. He has his apprentices come on and he explains how the geysers work and the artesian, you know, flow and so on and so forth. So that kind of gives you a little bit of a reassurance that what you're doing is it's kind of working. So that was a good news to hear that experts can appreciate what you do to entertain people. But yet it's just as realistic as it can be.
I will tell you from a fan perspective who is in absolute love and awe of Tokyo DisneySea. I think it is some of the most spectacular work Imagineering has ever done, and a huge fan specifically of that area. It's breathtaking. It is. It is jaw-dropping and breathtaking, especially seeing it, you know, from nighttime and going into daytime. But it's funny because you were talking about, talking about the mountains of Pandora, which, you know, exist only on film, and then the Cadillac Range in Cars, which is two-dimension animated, and then all these different other countries and cultures that you have to sort of build into. How much does the cultural storytelling impact creative decision-making?
A lot. Almost everything, because you have to be culturally very sensitive. That's really important for us. To make sure that every story we tell, it's told in a way where it doesn't offend anybody and it's, you know, it's faithful and it's entertaining. So we're building projects in France, in Shanghai, in Hong Kong, Tokyo, you name it, right? So every place we're building something, we have to be really, really super cautious about, make sure that the cultural references and where it's being built, you know, for the public, the majority of the people who will come, that they will appreciate the work that we've done without any kind of dismay or misunderstanding, which is a really complex thing to do, mind you. It's not as easy as I'm making it sound like. So, but yeah, we are very cautious and very, very, very focused on that.
And I was even thinking, you know, looking at Arendelle, I'm like, you have to build a frozen place for people that may not have ever even seen snow or understand what it's like to be in sort of a frozen environment, sort of convey that very quickly with just visuals.
Exactly. And that's your ammunition, pretty much, you know.
Yeah. Fantasy Springs, again, I just returned not too long ago and saw Fantasy Springs for the first. I didn't watch a single video. I'd like to experience
it
with my own
eyes. Great.
And
awesome.
Walking in and seeing, and I stopped. I mean, I literally stopped in my tracks when I looked at that rock work, because the storytelling doesn't take place when you step foot onto a ride vehicle.
Right.
The storytelling takes place from that, you know, that wide
shot
as you start, and then as you get closer and see the detail, and it's breathtaking to see in person. And then I love going multiple times during it, because what you see in the morning is very different than what you see in the golden hour. How do you sort of design to not just tell a story, but transform that story with light that changes, you know, naturally from the day to, you know, being artificially lit at night?
I wish we had more control over that, because a lot of time we design these beautiful things and the sun is always in the back, you know. So, You have to sometimes just work around it, frankly. But it is an important factor because, you know, it's sculpture. It's three-dimensional. You want to make sure that, you know, that the features and the details are visible. properly, meaning that you don't want to create something where the sun just hits it, you know, at 1:30 and you realize that something, you know, shows up that you didn't realize or you didn't meant to, you know, mean to do. So we have to actually, and that's why when we have buy-offs, for instance, or reviews, we always have at least a couple days in the schedule to do that, because we want to be able to look at it early hours, late hours, at night, you know, midday. So that's a very important factor for us, actually.
And you know, we were talking about the long shot, right? Said seeing it, and guests are seeing, when I say your work, I mean you and your team's work, obviously.
Of course, yeah.
You're seeing your work from a distance, and a lot of times it does sort of, it's background. I love getting close up, right? Because I love, whenever I see something, whether it's in a queue or whether it's in the landscape, you know, I'm like, somebody was here carving this and was very intentional in the design. Are there any details that you are either, you know, specifically proud of, or do you leave like little Zoltisms anywhere? Do you leave like little handprints and of some of the work that you've done?
Well, I hate to burst the bubble, but I'd like to think whatever we do as a project, that is the hidden thing. But yes, for instance, Fantasy Springs, you know, we had, that was, and it's an interesting comparison between the Tree of Life and Fantasy Springs. Those were the two major figurative, you know, sculpted, you know, projects. And the big difference is that on the Tree of Life, as long as it looked like a grizzly bear or a bass or a seagull or whatever that might be, then that was sufficient for the story. On Fantasy Springs, it was very challenging to make sure that all the characters are exactly how the people and the guests remember them from the movies. There was no little cushion that it kind of sort of looks like Rapunzel or kind of sort of looks like Pocahontas, but not quite. We could not afford that. It had to be just right. And you mentioned a minute ago about the two-dimension. You know, the movies are two-dimensional, right? So it was very challenging and interesting to create these figures in three-dimension. Because, you know, you look at the references and it's usually maybe one shadow line, maybe a couple of colors, and then you figure out the rest, right? And that's what we had to do. And Fabrice actually headed up a small, very small dedicated team, because I wanted to make sure that whomever's working on the figures, they are well qualified, so we don't have to redo and redo and redo. So it was Fabrice Canal and Fanny Rivera and then Fujita-san from Tokyo. And that was a small group who actually created all the figures. But what I wanted to do is really to make sure that it doesn't look like a sculpture garden. It tells a story that the water, the spring, the spirit of spring is sculpting these figures. So it's basically, you know, her backyard that she's kind of having fun, you know, going from one, you know, rock formation to the next and figuring out, okay, I want to sculpt Pocahontas here, or I want to do Peter Pan over there, you know. So that's the whole story. That's really the connective tissue between the three major attractions, which is Rapunzel, Frozen, and Neverland. So, but I wanted to do a little bit more and wanted to make sure that whenever you look at a scene, there's some kind of energy, a moment frozen in life between the figures. So there's a little communication. Somebody turns around, looks at the other one, you know. They're not just standing there looking in the air, you know. It's just, I wanted to make sure that whenever the guests come in, they feel almost like they just capture the moment that's it, you know. It might not be there 10 minutes from now. So that was something that we wanted to add as an underlying kind of offering, you know, for our guests. So it's interesting moving through the whole attraction, and every little scene has their own little, you know, moment and their own little ambience and message, really, to the guests.
Because I thought the same thing. I think, you know, we as guests, you know, we are experiencing this in all five senses in 360 degrees, and we go to Disney, we come back to Disney because of how it makes us feel, whether it's a character, whether it's a song, whether it's a story. And I have to imagine from you, there has to be some of that intentionality too, in you want guests to feel a certain way, whether consciously or subconsciously,
sure,
when they see you work. Talk about that sort of process and mindset.
I mean, you mentioned the fact that you like to get close, and we want to respect that. So why I think Imagineering is such a unique place and company to work with is because we pay a lot of attention to the smaller details as well, and that takes a lot of energy and takes a lot of focus and talent really and experience. And I think what's unique about what we do, that when the guests can, like you said, approach something and we force the perspective, we want to make sure that the attractions feel and look bigger than what they are. I mean, we're, let's face it, physically kind of, you know, controlled as far as how big the real estate is or how big the parking lot or whatever it is where we're going to build something new. So we're kind of constrained. So our only tool is to open up that world for our guests to really force the perspective with color, with proportions, with, you know, the level of detail kind of diminishing into the distance. So we're using all those tools to really make sure where the guests come in, there's this pow, you know, in the chest, like, oh my goodness, look at that. I never forget that story. We were opening Carsland, and Carsland was really a major kind of force perspective challenge, you know, with the Cadillac range and so on and so forth. So we're standing right behind that arch where you look through and you see kind of the whole lay of the land. And there was a rope across because it was just before the opening. There was this young girl with her mom waiting for the rope to drop. And then she started looking through under the arch and said, "Mom, look at that. You can walk for miles and miles and miles." And I was just right behind them. That really made me feel pretty happy and pleased that even a young person can, you know, realize or not realize, but can feel that trick that we kind of pulled, you know, to make sure that it does feel like you can walk for miles and miles. And that was great.
If it makes you feel right, it's not just kids that feel the way. I was there when they dropped that scrim and you were able to look down Route 66 and you saw that range. And you, like, you know, the air came out of the room because everybody's sort of jaws dropped, because it does give you that sense of perspective. And when you first start your journey and you go under that arch and that you get that powerful hit of music and the waterfall, it takes your breath away. But we are at Imagineering. You talked about team and you talked about Imagineers. I have to imagine that during your time growing up, coming to Disney, you were mentored by people, you were taught by the Imagineers that came before you. What do you look for in the next generation of Imagineers that you want to hand down what you've learned?
That's a big question, because really our job on one hand is to create, you know, wonderful projects and stories for our guests. But on the other hand, our job as well is to transfer that knowledge to the new generation. So we're at the stage, not just myself, but my whole team, we kind of grew up together. So we're in the same age range, if you will. But basically our job is to really develop and train and nurture a new generation. And that's really part of our responsibility. So it's a really big focus right now for us to really build up a brand new generation, a new team that can follow through for the next, you know, one or two decades to create what we have been creating. I was fortunate enough that I had great mentors from the very beginning. You know, one of them were John Olsen. He was heading up the character facade department at the time, but somehow he took me under his wing at Euro Disney or Disneyland Paris. And over the years, he really helped me kind of learn the ropes and learn, you know, the company, how you work with the company, you know, and all that. So that was very, very helpful. And I hope I can be, you know, a mentor for many, many people, young people to come. And I've been trying to do that over the years, of course. That's how you develop a pretty cohesive and a very talented team. Like in Fantasy Springs, you know, we had I think that was the largest team finishes community on any project so far. And we had about 55, 60 field art directors within the five disciplines that I was responsible for. And we spoke four languages every day, basically 12 nationalities, but 19 birthplaces around the globe work together, which is kind of fun. I never forget, we just started, you know, we just moved, started the construction. And at one point, I was giving some instructions But just so happened, it didn't happen after that, mind you. But at just one point, I wish I had somebody had a camera, or I would have had a camera, but I didn't. But as I was speaking, there was three different languages being interpreted to Japanese, you know, from English to Mandarin, you know, to Japanese, and from English to French to Japanese, and English to Spanish to Japanese. So we had all these international people who had to have interpreters to help communicate, which is another layer of to what we do, you know, within an international global industry. You have to be able to communicate your thoughts clearly and properly, and we rely on a wonderful group of interpreters that help us to do that.
Yeah, especially something so artistic, things can very easily get literally lost in translation as you're trying
even
to...
in English, let alone trying to interpret it from another language to another language, right? So that's a tricky thing, but it kind of helps you to learn how to communicate easier, cleaner, and more simple way to express your thoughts. So it's easier to convey that to the craftsman instead of the fancy words and, you know, complicated language.
Yeah. You know, you talk about passing on and being able, look, you obviously imagining brings on the best of the best in terms of creative and talented people. How do you, or what are some of the things that you try and instill in the people that come after you in terms of, you know, what you believe are some of the most important artistic values that they make sure that they either learn or hang on to?
Well, that's a good one too. It is very important that as we grow, the company grows, you know, the menu grows, to be able to maintain the quality that had been established, and that basically that the qualities are you know, our fame, our success, you know, the level of quality that Disney established, Walt, all the way down the line, to be able to maintain that and continue to be able to create that. And it's getting a little bit more and more challenging and difficult. I mean, you know, prices are going up and, you know, I mean, everything is changing. Technology is changing. You have to keep up with that, which is another great challenge within Imagineering, that we can be exposed really to the most cutting edge technology and try to figure out how to apply that to what we do, which is a project on its own, really. And I love that, by the way. We're working with research and development very closely and really trying to apply whatever we can possibly apply to be more efficient and more technologically inclined, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, and with that, because that's a double-edged sword, right? For
it
some
is.
People, you know, they're used to just building with their hands and technology. You know, the people who made the abacus were very afraid of the calculator that was. But for you, with AI and projection mapping and 3D printing, what are some of the new technologies that maybe don't concern you, but maybe excite you about what is coming now and what's coming next?
Concern. I think that it's going to be a point where it's going to be, you know, a real challenge to maintain the human art, you know? You know, people think, why would just pre-print rock work? You know, it's cheaper, faster, whatever. It's not. We're not there yet. But on the flip side, you know, do you want to print Mona Lisas and Giocondas and Raphaels and all that, or you want to appreciate what they did with their hands? So it is a little bit of a conflict within, you know, because to me, when you look at Cars Land or you look at the Tree of Life, today maybe somebody could 3D print that somehow, right? But the value is not the same. When you know that it was an international, wonderful team who worked every day, hand in hand, in the rain, in the cold, in the heat, in the humidity, and create something for a guest that they can come in and just, you know, being in awe. So that is that too. But that's such a big, in my mind, it's such a big conversation, a big, you know, what you call it. It really is an important subject. Because how do you protect the art and how do you move forward with technology? And I'm sure there's a happy medium. as long as we can find the happy medium, you know, because everything can be turned into, you know, AI and a digital form and so on and so forth. And we're heading very fast, you know, towards that direction. So it's going to be a little bit, maybe the next generation will have to deal with that more than we do, because we're kind of running out of time. but I think it's an interesting conversation, you know, for the new generation to, you know, what should we hang on to and what should we really just go to the moon with?
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah, because I think there's, you know, I don't know, I can't think of any other way to put it. There are certain things like that are artificially manufactured and printed that just, they're lacking the soul, right? They're lacking that sort of.
Exactly.
You can 3D print, you know.
All day.
The Pieta. It's not like going and seeing it and having, because you understand sort of the soul that is in there too. And I think that's what we feel when we see these places and spaces, because I think nobody does it better than Disney. You and your teams, the placemaking, the space making, you can tell that a human carved it, that a human designed it, and that there is soul and there's meaning and intent and purpose behind it too.
And I believe in that, and you're absolutely right. And that's what the little conflict is, you know, because you do want to modernize everything and you do want to move on with technology, but at the same time, are you losing the value or you're hanging on to that value? And what's the proportion?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I agree with you. I mean, when I see something, I know somebody actually did that with their hands. Interesting. We just, you know, funny enough, we're D23 last year, you know, and we decided, well, how could we represent the team finishes? So we decided we're going to basically sculpt a clay panel with, you know, Frozen and Peter Pan and, you know, kind of like referring to Fantasy Springs, you know, subject matters. And I didn't realize how successful it was. And not because we did it or, you know, how talented the sculptors were. It's just the fact that a lot of people brought up the fact that it's so nice to see something done by humans, you know, and not once. I mean, that came up several times a day, and that kind of reminds you of the value and really the equity of a human-made art.
Yeah. You know, again, Joel, I have a million questions I can ask you. I want to be respectful of your time, but we're talking about, you know, your time at Imagineering and the next generation of Imagineers, and I think when you start thinking like that, you know, the word legacy comes up. What do you want your legacy to be?
A tenacious, creative overachiever.
I love it. I love it. Is there, and I know,
I'm not sure if everyone likes it, but
no, but I think but it's who you are, right? And that's what you want to be.
I'd like to think that there are truly no limits, and sometimes people ask, okay, how do you do one project or the other, whatever. And, you know, since I was young, I really told myself that my internal goal is every day to do something better than I did yesterday, whatever that might be, right? And the fortunate situation was with me in my career that every project kind of led to another challenge. I remember after the Tree of Life, we had these interviews and they said, how can you outdo this? And I had no idea. It was, I don't know, you know. And then, you know, 2-3 years later, there's a, you know, a volcano, which is the largest man-made sculpture in the world. So, and then the floating mountains and then Galaxy's Edge. So it's all that. And Fantasy Springs. I mean, the fact that we created 50 plus Disney characters sculpted out of cement, you don't do that every year either. So it's been a wonderful journey and a great ride so far, being part of Imagineering and call yourself an Imagineering. I think that's probably the biggest honor you can have in our industry.
Is there one thing that you've done, not that you're most proud of, but that you hope every guest gets a chance to see and like, maybe I'll rephrase it this way. If you could take Walt Disney and show him one piece of your work, what would it be and why?
Ooh, I would be too bashful. Oh, man, that's a good question. It's like, you know, sometimes I say it's like picking out your favorite kid, but I think something that's very close to my heart, and the reason it's very close to my heart, because it was a small scale creatively very challenging, you know, project. It's the fountain in front of Hotel MiraCosta in Tokyo. Not a lot of people know that. They don't even know who, you know, whether Disney did it or somebody else. So that could be a little bit of a hidden treasure that most people don't realize that we had something to do with it. But that turned out really, really, really successful in my mind. And I don't think a lot of people actually connects that particular little feature with all the rest of the stuff that we've done in the year.
Because they're so quick to run in and go see Mount Prometheus. That's why. Yeah.
It's a shame.
That is the biggest, most beautiful weenie at the end that draws people in.
It's,
you know, I'm not the only person that loves just sort of spending time wandering around that place and space. And I think Fantasy Springs, you know, people were asking you about Tree of Life, what's next? It doesn't have to be bigger to be better. It's just different and unique. And I think Fantasy Springs is some of the most beautiful work, you know, that I've ever seen you and your team do.
It's an amazing team, truly. It's like, and I can't reiterate the fact that we have really the best in the world. It takes a lot of work, takes a lot of managing, taking care of those folks. But, you know, we work as an international team. Team Finishes is all international. You know, it's not like one country can do it all. So we have people from all over the world when we work together. But to answer your question back, you know, regarding Walt, obviously the Tree of Life and Pandora would definitely be something that if I can only show two things, those would be the two things for him. But of course, everything else is pretty cool too.
Yeah, I think it would be incredibly impressive. I know you speak Japanese and you talk about this idea of, I love the idea of Kaizen, this idea of continually improving. And I get the sense that that is sort of your philosophy and what you do in your work as well. And what you try and teach the managers behind you too.
Yeah. My goal is to always, until I'm completely done, to create everything better than I have done before. And hopefully I can pull that off somehow.
Well, your legacy is literally and figuratively etched in stone in Disney parks around the world. And your artistry and leadership really have helped bring some of these incredibly iconic environments to life, from floating mountains to galactic outposts. You don't just sort of build theme finishes. You really build these truly immersive storytelling places and spaces that transport us to another world. This has been an interview. I don't want to do the math. 30 years, and almost 30 plus years in the making for me, because I've been such an admirer of your work. So I sincerely appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. I could not be more honored, to be frank with you. Thank you so much for making the time, taking the time, and having me. Appreciate it.
Thank you once again for listening and for being part of the WW Radio family. Huge thanks to the team at Walt Disney Imagineering for inviting me out to Glendale, to Zolt for taking the time to sit with me while I was there, and of course for you for giving me this honor and privilege of being able to do that. I am so grateful for you. I hope that you found some magic in this week's show, and if you enjoyed it, please help spread the word, share the show, and tell a friend. Tune in again next week, but in the meantime, remember to be kind, choose the good, have an amazing day, and even better tomorrow. So until next time, stay hungry.